institutionalization of Black and Palestinian solidarity built on the foundation of this mass struggle that started with Malcolm X and the Organization of African American Unity, suffused through the Black Panther Party and others, and became just a generalized understanding. So it's just a part of the game. It's a part of Black politics. You know, there's going to be somewhat more pro-Palestinian views. And if you were like a Black politician who was for Zionism, it was very strange.
You're listening to Eugene Perrier, From Birmingham to Bethlehem, part one of a special two-part program. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So to come back around to the point about Black faces in high places, I think it puts it in a new context, you know, both generally and specifically towards Palestine. Because for America, they do this now. When they go around the world, doesn't matter what they're doing, they could just be massacring people left and right, but it's always for democracy. It's always for freedom. It's always for justice. The U.S. is always right. Everyone else is always just some evil authoritarian, this, that, and the third. No matter how bad it looks on the forefront, we just have no choice but to kill these people because it's for democracy, right? But it's hard to sell that story to people around the world because people around the world are very aware of the oppression of Black people in the United States and also the genocide of Native Americans. I've had the privilege, the distinct privilege, to travel to many different corners of the earth, most of the continents, and I can tell you, no one is confused about that fact. It is a very well-known fact. So when you're trying to preach to other people and say, do X, Y, and Z because of freedom, justice, and democracy, people are gonna say, well, why would I do that? Because you don't even practice it yourself. So who are you to tell me how I should be running my affairs? So ultimately, for the propaganda aspect of U.S. imperialism, you have to try to address this Achilles heel that you have. And so one of the main ways to do that is blackface, because you're not going to actually do anything for Black people. As I said, it's a feature, not a bug. And, you know, you can go across the whole spectrum. I think there are many people who are in mainstream politics or whatever who I think are against racism. But because they're unwilling to actually challenge capitalism and the foundations of racism and the actual construction of the capitalist system in America, they aren't actually able to advocate for solutions that meet the scale of the problem, that will really change the reality for Black people in America. So absent that, you got to do something to at least make it look like you were not a racist. And so this becomes a big acceleration in the 90s. How do we get as many Black people as possible in all these various institutions, even though the policies are going to be the same? And that's going to be very good for us because it's going to do two things. It's going to have people in other parts of the world maybe get confused, like, oh, okay, America, maybe they're actually doing something now. And also it's going to help lend the moral authority of the Black liberation movement to imperialism. Because inside of the United States, you know, it's always been the case that when Black people rise up in a profound way, all sorts of people, oppressed and exploited people, start to rise up alongside of them. You know, in the 1967 Detroit uprising, which of course is emanating from the Black community and about Black issues, they later went back about a year later and they did a study of who was arrested for sniping at the cops. And interesting fact, more white people than Black people were arrested for sniping at the cops. And it was because there were all these angry white people who'd come from Appalachia, who'd been promised these great factory jobs in the auto factories. It had definitely not worked out the way they thought they were going to. So when Black people were like, yeah, we're rising up and taking everything down, they were like, you know what? We're coming with you because this is our chance to make a move. And that's just one small example, but you can see this is the history, the civil rights movement, which catalyzes the modern movement for immigrant rights in the United States. I mean, that's what crushed the exclusionary policies of immigration with the Immigration Act of 1965, the politics of the civil rights movement and the context of it. The modern Native American movement, which arises, many of the early individuals who would form AIM and other organizations coming out of the civil rights era, having worked together, the Chicano freedom movement, same thing, right? So you can see this motion, Reconstruction after the Civil War. It tends to be that the Black struggle has a detonator effect, if you will, that sort of sets off a lot of different struggles and brings people up. So ultimately, if you can take the moral authority of the Black liberation movement and associate it with Palestine, as it had been, obviously that's going to strengthen the struggle for solidarity with Palestine in the United States. Because people who may have some question, maybe don't know that much, are going to say, well, hey, these leaders who I really respect from a struggle that I look up to are saying I should be working with these folks. So let me do that. But the reverse is also true, right? If you can take the moral authority of the Black Liberation Movement and attach it to imperialism and Zionism, it creates a space in people's minds that, you know, yeah, like, maybe I should be for this. I mean, that's why the Super Bowl ad with Martin Luther King's aid was all about the struggle against racism. You know, it's all about being against hate. And, you know, I'm all against hate. You know, we should stop anti-Semitism. But this is just a smokescreen. But you can see the kind of moral authority, like, what, you know, Israel, we're the same. It's the same thing. You know, we're just trying to be against anti-Semitism. That's what Israel's about. You know, just like against racism. And so it starts to muddy the waters about what's really going on. And it makes the possibility of breaking the link of solidarity in this country a lot stronger. So there's a lot at stake. You know, when Linda Thomas Greenfield is raising her hand to veto these resolutions, it was amazing to me because all the people behind her were also Black. I could be ignorant, but I feel very confident that everyone who works there is not Black. And it seemed very specific that they get them all, the six of them they got, are all lined up right behind her in the context of this, while the eyes of the world are on her, holding up her hand for this veto to confuse people about what's really going on. And the number one level of confusion was to elect Barack Hussein Obama as the president of the United States. Because, you know, listen, we all remember, some of us, I'm sure, remember it, you know, the nature of that New Yorker cover, you know, with Barack and Michelle in the Oval Office dapping each other up, dressed like Black Panthers, whatever. I think she had like a gun, you know, over her shoulder. The very tone of it, I mean, you know, she and he, to some degree, they're from the South Side of Chicago, you know what I mean? And she comes from a long family, actually, in the South Side of Chicago. His name is Barack Hussein Obama. It was like all this sort of, you know, rhetorical, image-wise things about what you should be afraid of from Black people, but like in a very acceptable way. So acceptable that they even had Joe Biden, like a racist, with them, you know? Like, and if he could be with it, like, we all could be with it, right? We forget that now because Joe Biden's whole thing is like, Black people love me. Let's see in November. But let's just remember, the whole reason he got picked in the first place is because Black people did not love him. And that racist would be more likely to be like, okay, I'm sorry, Barack Hussein Obama. Was he born here? I don't know, but he's got Joe Biden. And ultimately, this is the top imperialist position. So you put somebody in that position like that, it really starts to confuse people. And even the ones who aren't confused are in a position where it's like, well, what do I really say? Because obviously for the sort of cultural reality of America, to have a Black person be the president is big. I mean, you know, no Black people thought that was possible. For sure. And if you did, it was like you were just saying it just to say it. But that's why Colin Powell, who is, you know, a big imperialist. White people love Colin Powell. He's so well-spoken. He didn't run when they wanted him to run in 96 because he was like, come on, this is the United States of America. I can't win. So even someone who was like had every respectability checkmark was like, it can't be done. So ultimately, it's, you know, people are looking at that thinking, well, do I want to be the person talking down on that, right? So let me just maybe mute my criticism a little bit or try to find some way to kind of twist it or maybe blame someone under Obama and not really come at him. So you have the waters starting to get muddied significantly, specifically to break that link. And to sort of bring it to a close, I think this is what's so important about having the conversation about Black and Palestinian solidarity right now. Because the struggle that's taking place in general, but certainly within the Black community, is very much over this question of what Black politics really means, what it really should be, what its content actually should consist of. And you have the, you know, forget Obama now, he's gone, but, you know, the Hakeem Jeffries of the world, who had the nerve to go to a pro-Israel rally in 2014 and quote George Wallace, you know, it's really hard to fathom. Like, if you know anything about his district, like, this is like the blackest part of Brooklyn where definitely people are not really rocking with Israel, and he's become one of like the most pro-Israeli voices, right? So you have these people who are out there, you have all the individuals dealing with Biden, Clyburn, and all these other people, and they're saying that being in solidarity with this genocide is the essence of Black politics. But on the same token, you have a powerful grassroots uprising that is challenging that in a profound way that they don't even know how to deal with. I mean, you can see the African Methodist Episcopal Church, now one of the main religious institutions of the Black community, whose very existence is a protest in and of itself against the racist white churches, has now passed a resolution not just to have a ceasefire, but to end U.S. aid to Israel. And this is the same denomination that Biden went to Emmanuel AME Church in South Carolina and spoke at him was protested, and people said, oh, it was so bad. This was so disrespectful. It was so disrespectful that the church father said, no, we actually agree with the protesters, not the president. We're seeing with young people in the country, I mean, you know, Charles Blow from the New York Times had two separate editorials, op-eds, about this issue of Black Palestinian solidarity. The first one, which kind of caught a lot of, you know, people were paying attention to it. The second one didn't get as much, but the second one was more interesting because he said, I had to write about this again because the response was so deep, like the depth of anger amongst young Black people towards Joe Biden because of the genocide in Gaza was so deep, I actually wanted to go back and interview more people because it was more profound than I thought. And I can say, as I was reading it, I was pretty surprised because I can say, you know, I lived in D.C. for 15 years. A lot of these people were sort of like Democratic Party operatives. I don't want to say any names, but a lot of these names, I was like, damn, really? Because they were the type of people who really never took any bold stance because they didn't want to mess up their potential job opportunities in the next Democratic administration. Like, so people who, you know, I might actually call them sellouts, quite frankly. And I did, some of them. And here they are, like, yeah, like, we can't vote for this cat. Like, this is too much. He's gone too far. So you have this also happening at the same time. And so you have this really profound moment that's taking place where this axis of Black Palestinian solidarity is reemerging at a powerful moment in history. Because another connection in this moment, and this is why I wanted to start where I started with the history, because what's happening in Palestine is so critical for the entire globe right now. Not just from a moral perspective, but from a strategic perspective. Because what's taking place is the United States is facilitating this genocide to facilitate the so-called pivot to Asia, talking about Obama, to isolate China. Because the United States is losing dynamism. The economy, I know they tell you is good, it's not. One of the biggest problems they have is other countries have developed their own economies. And they're starting to say, like, you can't just set the terms of our exploitation and our oppression the way you want. At the very least, at least give us some say in our own exploitation. At the highest level, it's like we refuse to be exploited and oppressed by you anymore. So the ability to continue to disproportionately hold down the formerly colonized worlds is slipping away from them. And China is the key to that. It's a whole broader conversation. But ultimately, that's why they're saying that they're going to go to war. This is what the Pentagon is saying in the next 5 years. It's going to be a war between the U.S. and China, or at least we should expect it. The Marine Corps is saying we're changing everything we're doing because we have to be able to survive a nuclear conflict. So in their mind, this is what they're preparing for. Like, it's not, they're not playing. They really think, yeah, if we have to, we'll go to a nuclear conflict. But ultimately, if you want to take all your military power, you can only do but so many things at one time. So you got to get out of the Middle East, where you have everybody now, but that's still crucial. It's the crossroads of the world. It controls all the oil and gas going to Asia, which are all the biggest rising powers. And don't get confused. Even if the U.S. says, that's my friend, they don't just ride on friendship. They want to make sure that if you decide not to be their friend, that they can choke you out. So definitely, if you can take these rising economies and say, we have the military force to control basically everything you are doing, then it's a powerful weapon. You can't just leave. You can't just be like, all right, you know what? Y'all do your thing and move on. Because if you do that, the people of the area are going to be like, okay, great. If we do our thing, it's going to be very different from how you wanted us to do it. And you're not going to have the same level of control. And it's going to further erode and keep this trend going of declining power. So in order to check that, you have to find a way to keep your basic writ there. Keep the basic bargain that the British first made of having Israel as this central piece that is going to be able to continue to push forward the interest of these Western powers. Can't do it alone. You're saying you want to leave, so you have to create a normalization process where you get the most reactionary Arab regimes to work with Israel to keep anyone who wants to be too independent in check. So then you can move right over there to China and either kneecap them or end up in a nuclear war. So that's why Biden is facilitating the genocide, because it helps them. Every story that is out there that Biden is pressuring Netanyahu is fake. It's fake. I guarantee you, it's fake. I mean, not even just like distorted, it's fake. This is good for them. And we have to push back on that. Just because it's in the New York Times doesn't mean it's true. Nothing about what they're doing suggests that they're pressuring anyone. You can't say, please stop doing this, and here's $700 million worth of weapons right. to do it. It just is not realistic.
Yeah.
So ultimately, when you look at what's taking place, the Biden administration, I think, is like, okay, this is actually great. One, this huge amount of violence towards the Palestinians, maybe we'll be able to do something that we've never been able to accomplish, and that's crush the will and the capacity of the Palestinians to resist. Now, we know that they have completely failed in that task, but that's why they're facilitating it to have it keep going. Because the idea is like, well, we'll just kill enough of them, eventually they won't be able to fight back, and we'll be able to impose the solution that we want. Secondarily, you know, Israel, it was already losing some shine. It was already becoming pretty discredited. You could see the rise of people, BDS, other things like that. Israel has never been more isolated and discredited in its entire existence than now. Countries and people and organizations who went far out of their way to never take a position on the Israel-Palestine conflict are now taking a position, and oftentimes at least in soft solidarity with the Palestinian people. So you've got this challenge that means that the U.S. can impose upon them even more. Because they can say, well, look, if we leave, y'all are falling tomorrow. Like, look how what's going on right now. So ultimately, they can impose the solution that they want on the region, on both parties, through the agency of this genocide. So it's strategic. They're doing it on purpose because they know what's going on. And they also understand that this is a process that really is affecting certainly the entire world. It's affecting the United States. I mean, you think about, you know, as Martin Luther King said, the bombs exploding in other communities, in other countries, exploding in my own community. I mean, we can see that now. The military-industrial complex is draining the life from this country in order to drain the life from other peoples around the world so a handful of people can make a whole lot of money. Well, ultimately, at the end of the day, one of the biggest challenges they have then is if that Achilles heel comes back. And if the Black Liberation Movement stands in solidarity with the Palestinian people in a strong way, that all progressive people in the United States are going to say, yeah, we need to stand on this square. We need to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And it starts to become an obstacle. It starts to become an obstacle to achieving the goals that are in the survival of the rich and the elites. So this struggle is existential between the two. And it's why what we do right now is so important, because any little piece of space we can give to the Palestinian people, any way we can sort of declaw to some degree the U.S. imperialist reality, it's not just the freedom of the Palestinians, it creates space for the freedom of people all around the world. And if they're allowed to break the main axis of solidarity in this country that makes people want to stand with Palestine, they will be able to choke out more of the entire world. So that's why this history is so important, because it's playing out in a contemporary way that however it ends up will be one of the key determining factors over whether the rest of this century and probably the next century is going to be a century where we have more justice, more equity, where we address climate change, where we deal with poverty, where we deal with hunger. Are we going to do that? Or are we going to keep going the way we're going right now, which I think is the wrong direction? I mean, those are really the stakes that are on the table. That's really the context and the essence of what's happening right now in this country. I think that's what's so important about Black and Palestinian solidarity beyond just its own history and its own importance to both communities, is the strategic role it plays in the broader struggle for making the world much more just, much more fair, and I think much better. So I'll just end there, and thank you so much for coming out. I really appreciate it.
Talk about Edward Said's book, Orientalism, and the concept of Islamophobia.
Islamophobia today is in many ways sort of a form of Orientalism. I mean, you have to read the book. The basic sort of thrust of what Dr. Said is trying to put out is that there is sort of this othering of people in the formerly colonized world, this exoticizing of them in a certain way that also results in a certain level of demonization and preconceived notions about who they are, but about the nature of their culture. You know, the idea that like those people tend to be like this, and that sort of governs really the entire discourse in the West over how these places are approached. So that when you want to cover the Middle East, you're just bringing in certain notions ahead of time, because that's how those people are. And certainly I think we see this in the context of Islamophobia, in the context of what's happening in Palestine, one being that, you know, they're just like naturally violent people, and that there's something about the long history of tribalism and Islam and other things that have, you know, led them to have a certain element to their culture that is this, that, and the third. And I think that the way that it plays out here today continually is these sort of racist notions seep in. And they seep, I think the way it's most notable is in the small ways. Like when people come out and say things that are very racist, it's like very obvious. And I think this is one of the elements of Orientalism, is that, you know, that is easy to kind of dismiss. But when it's sort of couched in sort of a what might be called a learned guys, right? Where it's sort of based on your deep knowledge of the region. Because notice how all these Western journalists, you know, that are always reporting, and academics, you know, that have the deep knowledge of the region. They've reported from there for 30 or 40 years. But their ultimate conclusions always end up in this idea that somehow there's some othering thing about them that you can't understand. Everything else, like, they're not really like us in that way. And I think that we've done so much since 9/11 to create this reality in the Arab and Muslim world that somehow they're just like not really like us. Like, you know, the democracy doesn't really come naturally to these people, right? I mean, if you look at the history of their empires and their, they may be great and they may be this, but, you know, they didn't have the same democratic enlightenment traditions that we had, and that continues to affect their ability to do X, Y, and Z. I mean, all these so-called learned and intelligent analyses that are really deeply rooted in a form of racism. And I think that's why that book had such a huge impact when it came out in the late 70s and the 80s, because it was revealing how so many of the received wisdoms and received truths were based on these, you know, basically like British colonial office formed ideas of what it meant to be an Arab or a Muslim or an Indian and how those interacted. You know, I mean, they used to say there is no India, right? It's just a bunch of different types of people, and you have to understand their characteristics and be able to put the, and this is the rationale for the British Empire. So I think we're in a similar moment where the empire is rationalizing its existence by creating narratives about people that, you know, may be rooted in some level of fact or truth, but is really designed to create an othering in your mind that they are different from us, that they're like a different form of humanity, that it's hard to really understand them, and that the things we hold dear, they do not hold dear, right? Like, I mean, you know, here's one. People in the Arab and Muslim world don't support women's rights. Strange thing for America to be saying.
Right.
You know, I mean, a country that is basically based on selling women on the auction block to sell commodities is saying that some other group of people is like, yeah, they just don't believe in women's rights. But that's like axiomatic. It's axiomatic. You know, that if you wear a hijab, that you must be oppressed. Right? I mean, that's axiomatic. It's true. If you in any major newspaper, that's what they think. That's what they teach you in school. And if you say that you're not, well, you're just brainwashed. Or, you know, if they're interviewing you in that country, you're worried you're going to be assassinated or killed or whatever, so you can't speak freely. Right? I mean, these are the things that people don't even question when they come up as mainstream media narratives. No one even looks at the reality of the United States. No one ever really asks that if the only way to make it in Hollywood as a woman is to get naked on film if somehow you don't have agency. No one ever really thinks about that. Or if Hollywood doesn't respect women's rights. Or if America doesn't respect women in its essence. No one ever says that. Right? But if you wear a hijab, you must be oppressed. No one ever interrogates it, and that lack of interrogation creates the space to kill people. Because when you can other someone, and when you can think they don't value what you value, that they're somehow a little less human than you are, it's a lot easier to kill them. That's why in every single war, you know, whoever the enemy is, there's some slur that you refer to them as, because it helps dehumanize them. Because, you know, killing is bad. People don't really want to kill people, other people in general. It's something that, you know, you have to have a reason to do it. And so they create this sense. And we've created this sense that has made it so easy to wage these wars all around the world and to assume people are evil, you know? If you just say, Assad is evil, okay, case closed. Iran is evil, case closed. Palestine, Hamas, evil, case closed. I mean, the fact that there's no facts about like 90% of what they're saying about Hamas, but people are still like, well, I mean, it's Hamas, right? It's Hamas. But no one is ever saying that about the United States, who's killing way more people than Hamas has ever dreamed of killing. The number of people Hamas has killed compared to the U.S. government is no competition. But there's no thought that America is teaching its children to hate. No one says America has this genocidal intent to destroy all people. And it doesn't even make sense. But again, when you have this concept, this othering, this orientalized spirit, it becomes easy to continue to repeat these things. And, you know, as it's been said before, if you repeat a lie enough times, it becomes the truth. And I think that's a lot of what's happening right now. But I know my chair is on me now. We're going to stop there. Yeah. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming out. I really appreciate it.
You were just listening to Eugene Perrier, From Birmingham to Bethlehem. Eugene Perrier is a journalist, activist, and public speaker. He's a founding member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and he's the host and producer of Breakthrough News. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Medea Benjamin, Arundhati Roy, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Eugene Per Year, From Birmingham to Bethlehem, Parts 1 and 2, and for the classic Howard Zinn book, A People's History of the United States, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Hep Ingham, Terry McRae, and KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Bob Dylan singing Blind Willie McTell.
Seen the arrow on the doorpost, saying this land is condemned. All the way from New Orleans to Jerusalem, I traveled through East Texas, where many martyrs fell, and I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell. Well, I heard that hoodah singing as they were taking down the stars above the barren trees, was his only
the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPERG, has been leading social and environmental activism on campus for 40 years. SFPERG is student activism, by students, for students. Do you have a vision for a brighter future? Are you passionate about changing the world? Visit us at www.sfperg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about getting involved today.
Hey, Are you a First Nations, Métis, or Inuit student? Not convinced university, college, or vocational trade school is possible? Or wondering what you should do after high school? Inspire can help you and your friends. Register for Inspire's free Indigenous mentorship program, Rivers to Success. Joining Rivers to Success gets you access to great information, great prizes, and exciting content. Discover careers and post-secondary paths geared towards Indigenous students across Turtle Island, just like you. Register online today at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca. Prizes, information, and fun are waiting.
Thank you for tuning in.